Accession number 20578, wheel 4.
Johnny M's wheel 4.
This was on the top of my head from an airburst. And the third one was in Sicily. That was in my right eyebrow, but that's to come later. No, the fighting was finished. I didn't take part in the victory parade in Tunis. We sent a detachment, and it was fantastic how smartly turned out these men were after all this fighting, months and months fighting mud and terrible conditions in Tunis. Yeah. I believe it was a sight to behold. Certainly our men were very worthy representatives of the battery. You know. Next we moved to just inland from Bizerta, where getting ready for the next phase. Now, quite obviously, we'd cleared North Africa. We're going to Europe, but where in Europe are we going? We milled about in the back of Bizerta for a time, and then the next thing was we were taken down to Sousse. Sousse is in southern Tunisia, right on the edge of the Sahara Desert. And there we were obviously preparing to go and land in Sicily. There was a vast number of troops there, British and American, and one of the things was water shortage. For some days we were on 2 pints of water per man per day, and we had to put a guard on the water wagon because once you've had a drink, you needed to have another one. We used to drink when we got up and then not drink during the daytime at all and then have a drink in the evening. We trained there and messed about. Got ourselves tidied up. And then one evening we loaded onto the landing craft. This time these are big, I think they're called landing craft ships. They're big, 2,000 tons, great big jobs. Rather like a cross-channel ferry, you just drive in through the open doors. The only difference is they haven't got doors the other end. You've got to go in backwards so that you're driving out in the proper direction. Loaded on this ship, and pushed out to sea, forming up into the convoy. I don't know when it was, but we saw the gliders being towed to Sicily, ready for the airborne troops to do their landing. And at some stage we pushed off a great big convoy of these landing craft with the supporting ships. I'm a great believer in creature comfort. You never know what's going to happen yet. Doing these landings, and so I found myself a stretcher to lie on. The stretcher was lashed to the side of the passageway, and I undid this, undressed, stripped out naked, got a blanket, pulled it over myself, went to sleep, and I was wakened up in the night sometime, an American captain, infantry captain. It was an American manned ship, and he said, "Are you in charge of these British soldiers?" I said, "Well, I'm in charge of some of them." "Why?" He said, "Well, they're sleeping there with their boots off." And I said, "Well, look, I'm naked." And he promptly put me on a charge. And I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, supposing we get torpedoed on the way over." I said, "Look, if we get torpedoed, I'm darn sight better off than you are." He got his revolver, his map case, his hat. He was ready for battle in the middle of the night. I never heard any more of the charge, but it just showed the different attitude. The British were so experienced at this, we took it in our stride. The Americans were a bit of a panic state. It begins to get light, and there we are, Sicily's coming into view. The Canadians had already landed. I think it's called Cap Pescino or Cap Passero. It's the extreme southeast corner of Sicily. And we're coming in. I thought, my God, you know, they better slow this ship up. We're going to hit a most awful crash. I don't know what speed we were doing, 7 or 8 miles an hour, I suppose. And we just drove into Sicily, wallop, like that. And Sicily, to me, is one large lump of pumice stone. And the noise was appalling as it tore the bottom out of the ship. But I shouted to my men, hang on for something, because the impetus, anything that was loose, shot forward. The doors flew open, and God, we were an awful muddle. But we picked ourselves up and got out. We'd got ordinary gun-towing vehicles and 25-pounders. And as soon as we got ashore, we were in trouble. Streams of Italian soldiers who'd been defending this bit of coastline, They'd seen the ship. My God, we can get off Sicily. Their one ambition was to get out of Sicily as quickly as they could. And we were considerably hampered trying to catch the Canadians up by the Italian soldiers trying to get a ship out of Sicily. But that was it. I don't remember an awful lot about Sicily. It was extremely unpleasant. It's very rocky, very hot. Any shell bursts or mortar bursts, you didn't only have the splinters to deal with, you've got great lumps of rock flying about. And Sicily was very tough fighting and very tough on the vehicles. The Americans went up the left-hand side, the western side, and we went up the eastern side. And we got on beyond Etna, I don't know where, but it was pretty continuous fighting one way or another. And then, obviously, Sicily was going to be captured completely. And so we were pulled out, and we went to a port called Catania on the east coast of Sicily, and loaded up in landing craft back to North Africa, ready for the next phase. I remember in Catania, these landing craft, quite a long way out of the water on the deck, and they were British this time, and the order over the tanner was hands to bathe. Oh, God, lovely. So unthinking, I just stripped off on the deck and dived in. God, I'd never dived for more than 6 feet before. It seemed about 30 feet. I was quite alarmed. But we hustled out because the Germans started bombing the anchorage, and it's not advisable to be in water when bombs are dropping because the shock kills you. But that was it. We got out. We came back, and I don't know where we landed in back in Africa. And this would be the end of August, I think. I can't remember the exact dates. Latter part of August, we're back in Tunisia again. There was a slight upset. We were told to go to a certain map reference, and we went to it. And it was lovely and quiet. We were outside a city of Constantine, which is a beautiful city in Tunisia. And we just sat there, and nothing seemed to happen. We got rations, and it was a very pleasant life, thank you very much. And then there was something of a panic. The battery was missing. We'd been sent to the map reference, but we were supposed to go to the same map reference we'd meant to go to the map reference in Tunisia, and we'd gone to Algeria. It was just a sort of military cock-up that happens every so often, but that was sorted out. And then it was decided that we would have our role reversed again. We handed in the 25-pounders, and we drew our old friends, the 3-7 howitzers. This time, though, the Mulebourne sort with wooden wheels. And we went to a little seaside port in Algeria called Djigeli. And there we proceeded to train as a mountain battery. One of the many problems was that only two or three men in the battery had ever seen a horse or a mule. My signaller gunner Bell had. He was a Derbyshire coal miner, and he'd seen a pit pony, but that was about his knowledge. Fortunately, some of the men who had come to join us to make up casualties were reservists who'd done their time in the regular army between the wars, and a lot of them had experience of mules and horses. But it was a terrific shake-up. I, in my farming experience, was used to animals, and of course the regular officers, they'd all trained as horsemen. We got the first draft of mules. They came to a port called Bougie. They were Argentinian mules, magnificent animals. Some of them were up to 16 hands, which is very big. And we were formed from an independent battery. We became part of a regiment, 7th Mountain Regiment. One of our sister batteries, 456 Independent Battery, became one, and then 479 Battery was formed by taking a cadre from each of the two existing ones. So there we had a three-battery regiment of 3-7 howitzers, Mulebourne. We acquired a colonel, one of the old school, who didn't approve of our dress, which was ordinary army boots and bush shirts and shorts. All the officers would have boots, real proper riding boots. We were shown a sample, and we were told we've got to buy these. Well, the cost of them was about equal to a month's salary as a subaltern, I think. It was a bit of alarm and despondency, but fortunately, some Tunisian, Algerian Arab, who are light-fingered at any times, got into his tent and pinched his boots, and so the order was rescinded. We wouldn't wear boots, so that was all right. I had to go to, I think it was Bougie, to collect the first load of mules, brought them back, and they were split up into the three batteries. They weren't broken in, they were halter broken, that's to say they were used to having a halter on and being led, but they'd never been saddled. And imagine the job of training these mules to be saddled, to walk, march, keep in line, keep in file, and so on, and later to have the guns loaded on them. Because the guns break down into 8 bits, various loads, as the shield and slipper, and the wheel and axle, and the barrels, and the buffer recuperator. And these loads have to be lifted onto the mule's saddles. Each mule had its own special saddle to accommodate the special bit of the gun. And the mule had got to be trained to stand still while the gunners loaded these great bits of metal on and fixed them on. But it was done, and we got away with it quite well. We had one interesting experience. The British soldiers weren't used to mules, and they didn't like them, and a lot of the mules didn't like the British soldiers. And when we were what's called in mule lines, the mules are tethered with a rope to a picket, and they're tethered by their hind leg, off hind leg one day and near hind leg the other day, so they can't turn around and kick each other. But the gunners had to groom them and feed them, and they were apt to get kicked, and so the gunners were apt to kick the mules. And the veterinary sergeant, and we had on the battery, said to the battery commander, "Look, I think the mules are being kicked by the gunners because they're getting bruises and cuts on their bellies." So the order went forth that gym shoes only will be worn in the mule lines. I was orderly officer, and I go down to the mule lines, and there's Gunner Blobbin at his name, stark naked, except for a pair of gym shoes. So I said, "Well, yeah, what are you doing?" He said, "Sir, the order yesterday said gym shoes only will be worn in the mule lines. Gym shoes only I'm wearing." British soldier's humour. Nothing I could do about it. But anyway, we sorted these mules out. And next thing was horses. We'd got to have horses for the officers, for certain signallers. As usual, I get the job, go back to Bougie, collect. I'm told there are 12 horses. Nobody knew anything about them. Find them in. I took a lorry load of men to Bougie Station, and there they were. There were the horses, all right, in the train, in the wagons. All stallions, all tied up by their halters to the side of the wagons. I don't know when they were last watered, but of course, being the lieutenant, I got to set the example. So I have to go into the wagon, sort these wretched things out, untie one, lead it out, hand it to a gunner. Didn't enjoy the life at all. But we got them all out, and we had to walk them about 30 miles to the camp at Jijili. And we managed quite fine. We got along, and these were broken, the horses, the stallions. They were all right. And they were duly apportioned out. Lovely animals. Then the next draft of animals came along, and again I go and collect. And this time they're not stallions, they're geldings, castrated stallions, and mares. It's like a circus, because I remember one particular occasion, the battery commander, Major Gunn, was mounted on a mare, and the trumpeter was mounted on a stallion. And we didn't have Viagra in those days, but the stallion was feeling fruity, and he mounted the trumpeter, mounted the major on parade. It caused a lot of laughter amongst the troops, who were a bit sex-starved anyway, but this was the sort of shambles that occurred. The poor stallions suffered because they all had to be castrated, and that was the end of our troubles. It's lovely how you remember these foolish episodes. Anyway, we trained, and the thing was harden the animals and harden the men, because from now on we're not riding anymore, we're going to walk everywhere. And we practiced uphill, down there. We found some really steep hills, and we evolved a very interesting drill. We always moved in exactly the same order on the line of march. That's to say, Gunner A and Mule A always went in front, and Gunner B and Mule B always followed. And everyone got used to this. And what we did was, when we came to an extremely steep hill, and I mean extremely steep, you'd have a job to walk up it. What would happen, Gunner A would lead his mule up this slope. Gunner B behind him would loop his rein over his right arm and would hang on to the tail of Mule A. And Mule A would give him a bit of assistance up the hill. Now, this was quite acceptable. You'd think the mules would raise hell, but no, they accepted it. But in exchange, when going down a very steep hill, the reverse thing, Gunner B would hold the tail of Mule A and keep him straight down the slope, because if he got sideways on over the slope, he would almost certainly roll. And when you think that one of the mules was carrying 360 pounds, I think, was the weight of his top load, right on his back, then if he went, he rolled. And not only would the mule get hurt, but perhaps the gunner be damaged. So this sort of rapport was established between the mules and the men. And it's unbelievable, really, in a way, that this happened. But it did. It was accepted. The training went on, and the next thing was, Italy had been invaded. We were lucky. After Sicily, we were originally due to go and do the landings at Salerno and support the landings there, but we'd been so shot up, and the vehicles and guns had been so damaged from the terrain in Sicily that we couldn't get ready in time. That was why we became this Milbourne lot. Next thing was to move to Italy. I think it would be in about January 1944, probably, that we went to Italy. Anyway, my recollection is that we went in transport, whether it was train or lorries, I don't know, to Algiers, where we were to load the guns and the mules of the battery onto a ship to take them to Italy. I can picture the docks there, and a ship, a French ship called the Forte de Duomo, was to take us. She was tied up to the dock. The guns had been loaded. The vehicles went on the Forte de Duomo. The guns had been loaded, and then the mules were to be put aboard. And the method is, you put out a cargo net, which is perhaps 8 or 9 feet square, with a foot made of a 4-inch mesh. You laid this flat on the thing. On each corner there is a D-shaped bit of metal. The mule is led onto the net. The boom or the crane lowers a wire with four wires spreading out. Hooks are put in each corner. The wire is then tightened up. The mule gets lifted up. His legs go through the mesh, and he's swung onto the ship. And there the reverse process happens. No bother at all. We didn't have any great trouble. Unfortunately, we had one mule called Dynamite. Dynamite was a very big grey, and he was temperamental. He would go all day and he'd carry anything, but if he was awkward, he was awkward. And the gunners knew this, and somehow he got left till last to be loaded. It was a great mistake. We should have taken him first and have been no bother, because he decided he wasn't going to be hauled up. This was too undignified for him. But eventually the gunner managed to get him onto the net. But he wouldn't go quite far enough onto the net, and an Arab stevedore who was assisting, wearing a gas cape, which was a plastic cape which we wore in time of gas attack, stood behind and flacked it, and it makes a horrible rattling noise. Dynamite didn't like this. He gave him both hind legs somewhere in the belly, and the poor Arab was knocked over the side of the wharf into the sea. I witnessed this from the Forte de Duomo rail, watching it, and I don't know what happened to the Arab. Dynamite was all right. The trip over to Italy was quite exciting, because we were flying a barrage balloon to stop any low-flying aircraft attacking us. And although you think of the Mediterranean as being lovely and placid and blue, by God, sudden storms brew up, and this did with us. And it was very, very rough, and there was thunder and lightning, and the balloon got struck with lightning, and it fell onto the ship. Now, the mules were down in the hold, along with a lot of straw and stuff. And if the balloon, had, flaming balloon, had gone in there, we would have had a problem. But it, luckily, it bounced over the side of the ship into the sea, so we were spared that one. We got to Salerno, the port of Salerno, which was a shambles. There were sunken ships, or usual sort of aftermath of bombing raids. And we couldn't get to the wharf to unload. We had to unload onto a ship that was lying on its side, walk across that, and then onto the wharf itself. And the problem was to get the mules across, because you couldn't, the boom wasn't long enough to swing them over the ship onto the wharf. So they got to be unloaded from our ship across a plank bridge, a wooden plank bridge, I don't know how wide or how long it was, across this ship lying on its side, and then across another plank bridge up to the wharf. And of course, you know, junior officer, I get the job of leading the way. So I thought, well, I know what we'll do. I'll have dynamite, because if dynamite will go, you know, we're all right. Now, dynamite didn't like look at this plank bridge at all. He wasn't going to play that game. So I took, I had a leather jerkin, the ordinary army issue leather jerkin. I took this off, and blindfolded dynamite with him, took his halter rope, come on, and he walked across the plank behind me. I didn't look down, across the ship, across the other plank, to the wharf. Once one mule ago, all the others followed just like a lot of sheep. It was one of the jobs I could have done without, I must say, leading the blasted mules across this wooden plank bridge. It was probably wider than I remember, but it was a hairy job. That was typical of dynamite. If he would go, the others would follow. We landed at Salerno, and then we moved inland. By now, we're footborne all the time. We don't have lorries. We had lorries to supply us with food and forage for the animals. I forget the name of the place we went to. It might have been Eboli, a bit south of Salerno and inland, in the foothills. And there we sorted ourselves out and trained. And we were given Italian muleteers. We'd had, for a time, we'd had Basutos in North Africa, and they were withdrawn, but we had Italians. The Italians were in a muddled state. They'd been fighting on alongside the Germans, and then Mussolini gave in, and a lot of the Italians changed sides, and these soldiers were ones that changed sides. They were actually Alpini. They were probably amongst the best Italian soldiers. And they wore their little Alpini hats, and they used to sing lovely, low, bawdy Alpini songs to us at night. But they were very, very good muleteers. We got on very well with them, indeed. They had, in the regiment, there was Captain Vella, the Italian. He was in charge of them. My battery was Lieutenant De Basi, the solicitor from Padua. And none spoke any English, but and very few of the Italians did. But we had one, an Italian private soldier called Telefono. He spoke good English, and he was the interpreter for De Basi. And all day long you'd hear De Basi shout, "Telefono! Telefono!" And poor Telefono would go up and translate the orders for him. And then we got them fine. They were good soldiers. We worked our way northwards until eventually we caught up with the fighting. I don't know where it was. Perhaps Campo Basso or somewhere there. And we spent the entire Italian campaign walking the length of Italy, always in the Apennine Mountains, the spine of Italy. Sometimes on the western side, sometimes on the eastern side, sometimes just about over the ridge. In the winter, appalling. The weather was simply terrible. Mud, wet, cold. No big scale. I was not involved in any of the big scale battles in Italy, except just Cassino. All little scraps. As the armies, the Americans generally on the left and the British generally on the right, advanced up Italy, we kept pace up on the Apennine Mountains, supporting, I suppose you might even call them irregulars, Popsky's private army one time, Lovett scouts, Gurkhas, all sorts of people in this, not spectacular big fighting, but very wearying stuff, because You never knew when you were going to get walk round a corner and get shot at from some chap who was hiding behind a rock. The mules, though, were absolutely our saviour, because we were never short of rations or food or anything. The system was that men's rations or mules' rations, hay, corn, were brought as far forward as they could with a lorry. They were then transferred to jeeps and trailers, who brought them as far forward as they could get. Then they were loaded onto the mule backs and brought up to the gun position, because besides the gun, the mules carrying guns, we had the supply mules and signals mules and so on. The vet had a mule. Now, we did well. It was very hard work keeping the infantry supplied all the time, but for us, we did well. One spectacular occasion, we'd had a miserable day. It was one of these filthy, wet days, and we'd been shot at, we'd been mortared. It was a very worrying day, and it came night time, and the trouble started because Bell had run out of tobacco. Bell, my signal, the most trustworthy man, he'd stand anything, but he must have his tobacco. Oh, God, he'd run out. So right, I sent a wireless message back to the battery. Send a man up with some tobacco for Bell. By now, I'm battery commander. I'm major. I'll tell you the story in a minute. One of the lieutenants came up in dark with a mule, an ammunition mule. The ammunition is carried in leather panniers on the side of the mule. No ammunition on it, but strapped inside was a tin of tobacco for Bell and a bottle of whiskey for me. So we always got well supplied. But no, that was a very unpleasant day. Now, I went to Italy as a lieutenant. And at some stage, I don't know where it was, our battery commander, Major Gunn, I was up with him. We were both in OPs a few yards apart. And he got very badly wounded with a mortar bomb. He was evacuated. And a chap called Captain Tom Hardy, who came from 457 Battery, he was promoted major and commanded our battery. And poor Tom Hardy, only about 2 days later, I think he trod on a mine, which were prolific, they were all over the place. And he was badly wounded, and I was promoted major, so I'd made extremely rapid promotion, but I'm battery commander then. But say, we fought our way up Italy. Summertime it was lovely and hot, but too hot sometimes. Wintertime, bitterly cold, absolutely incredibly cold. Snow, we were permanently in snow, and to protect the mules a bit, we had to build walls of snow by making snowballs and rolling them up, because the mules were absolutely vital. Rations were a problem. Like everything else in the army, it was ordained how many pounds of hay each mule had per day, and how much oats, crushed oats or whatever it was, how much straw. They even make provision that you get more straw for a male mule than you do for a female mule, because the male pee is in one place and dung's in another. But we got these rations, but up in the snow it wasn't enough. The fodder wasn't getting the mules going. The rations were designed for the ordinary RASC mule, who much smaller and used largely. I had powers to requisition hay, and I would go with the Italian translator, telefono, to a farm and say that I got to requisition a haystack. Italians couldn't argue that I'd sign a chitty. I'd explain to them that they would be paid in due course by a thing called AMGOT, and I forget what it stands for. They were the sort of civilian body that followed us up, and I would sign it. And 70 quintals of hay, major ACM, RA, move on. But it wasn't enough, and several times I had to exceed my powers, and I would go and requisition and sign the chitty, 200 quintals of hay, May West or Tom Mix or anyone that name came in. Meant nothing to the left, no, nothing to the Italian farmers, and that was it. It caught up with me. Later on, this is much later on, up in outside Florence, I went down with infective hepatitis, jaundice. very prevalent up there. Strange enough, only amongst the officers. The other ranks didn't seem to suffer, and I got this breasty stuff. Makes you feel like death. And MO came up and said, go on, you evacuate. We were supporting Poles at the time, and I was evacuated through the Polish army system. They had their women right up fighting with them, and a great big woman stuck a thing like a barometer in my mouth and announced that my temperature was 36 or whatever it was. Didn't mean a thing to me, and